am George Knapp, listening to That UFO Podcast and having one hell of a good time.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. My name is Andy, and joining me as we head into March 2024 for a look at some news, talking points, and other little bits and pieces from back in the UK temporarily, I have Dan. Dan, welcome.
You had to think about where I was then, didn't you?
Partly that, and also how that even though you're back in the UK and closer, your internet connection's so much worse. So that won't come across in the release of this. Yeah, that won't come across in the release, folks. That'll all be fixed. However, here we are. Dan, going to get right into things, okay? Because I don't think there's lots of major talking points, but there's lots of stuff that I think is worth talking on. And some of it, like you mentioned before we hit record, bleeds into other bits and pieces and got some questions off of folks as well. So I want to just kick off with eminent domain, Dan. So this was something that came up back during the old Shimmer Rounds days. Remember those days, all those weeks ago? It seems like much longer. But the old UAP Disclosure Act, which at one point seemed like it would potentially be pretty groundbreaking. But if you held your breath too long, you went blue in the face with that one, because it was roundly, pun intended, torn to bits by the Four Mics, as they were known. Sound like a kind of 60s Motown band. But yeah, that was torn to bits and we never really got anything out of it at all. The two big talking points, and I'm doing this from memory, Dan, was one, there was going to be a presidential review group made up of an independent, you know, independent scientists, economists, analysts, scientists, that kind of stuff. And they were going to basically help declassify records going back to, you know, the 40s, for example, on all things UFO, UAP. However, there were still caveats within that president whoever at that point could say, no, we're not declassifying that. So there still was limitations to it. The other big talking point, which is what I'm trying to get to here, was eminent domain. Essentially, for the layman like me, it was that the government, quote unquote, or whoever would be in charge of this group, could basically go in and say Lockheed Martin, Boeing, British Airways, whoever has pieces of extraterrestrial or non-human craft, we want it back. You were given it some time ago, or you got it by whatever means, we can just come in and take it. That was quite a popular item to be part of it. The first time I heard any opposition to it, Dan, was when I spoke to Jeff Nucitelli, and he said on the recording I'd done with him, he was very much against it. And I think I was surprised when he said that. But then when he explained it, it made a little bit of sense. He was like, you know, if you've got private individuals who do have their own samples or material that they don't want to give up, then why should they have to? And I think there's a bit of a conversation there. So this has reared up recently, hasn't it, online and been quite a big discussion point.
Yeah, that's right. So it came up online because it turns out in a bunch of FOIA releases, there were some emails where Brandon Fugel of Skinwalker Ranch fame, he owns it, he you know, runs it, everything like that. Also Travis Taylor, who was the head scientist for the UAPTF or the UAP Task Force. Apparently they opposed it to the representatives. We also had Jack Vallée at the Seoul conference opposing it right after Carl Nell laid out what it would be for in his talk. And there's been a lot of to and fro in and things like that. But I think what it comes down to essentially is, you know, with contracts, whatever you sign is what you've put your name to. That's it. You can't go back on it. And I think probably what's happened is a few people were concerned that these materials that they had were going to be taken out of their hands. They disappear into the US government, never to be seen again. Kind of like what's happened with the business stuff from To the Stars at the moment, right? Like it just disappeared into a black hole. We haven't
had that agreement.
That's right. And so everything just disappears into a black hole. So it seems that the Schumer rounds, everyone like that, wanted to pass it and kind of say, look, we can change this later. We can discuss the terms. We can change it later, you know, down the road. And it's a discretionary thing. You know, we're not going to come after you. This is for Lockheed. This is for, you know, big aerospace who have been holding this. However, Brandon being Brandon, the savvy businessman, he's not going to sign a contract that isn't word for word perfect and what he's happy with. He's not going to sign, change it later. He's going to say, we'll change it now. I'll sign it. And then we can go forward. For whatever reason, that didn't happen. which to someone like Brandon, it would make him narrow his eyes a little bit, right? You know, they don't want to change it. What? Mm. Like, we've got the time. Why are we doing this? So it was opposed by people, and I think reasonably so. Now, what we have is an opportunity to kind of pass it to the next year, which is 2024. We'll have another NDAA coming forward this year. Other legislation can be pitched and things like that. And that language can now be worked on, and the solutions can be found to these issues. If they didn't want to take it off private individuals, it should say that in the language, I feel. And then it just, you know, calms those nerves about having these things taken off them. You know, for example, the scenario is if they found a UFO underneath Skinwalker Ranch, dug it up, the government could just come in and take it off them. It's not going to be something we ever know about. It won't be in the TV show. They won't be able to talk about it. And that's not really what we want. Perfect is the enemy of good, but at the same time, we need this base level to be correct. So last year, out of all the Schumer Round stuff, the thing we got passed were the UAP repository in the archives, the National Archives, which is now launched. Things are going up there. The two things that got passed forward for this to kind of be considered this year are the review board, as you correctly pointed out, and the eminent domain stuff. There are plenty of other solutions to the eminent domain stuff that doesn't involve kind of strong-arming people, but just kind of registering what you have so it can be kept track of and the government can look at it if they want to and it can be studied. But I can't see anyone signing their name to something that says, hey, if you find a piece of exotic technology, it's no longer yours, you know?
Yeah. So I fully understand everything you've said. And thinking it through, is it not the issue that this has to be one of two ways? Either it's completely non-negotiable, all items from individuals, private company, private sector, whatever it may be, have to be handed over if asked, or then it's a no-go. Because isn't the issue, as soon as you do start leaving caveats and loopholes, that what we're, like you say, what we're talking about, and let's just use Brandon Fugel as a private individual, billionaire philanthropist playboy, as he is, and I add that in jokingly, that whole Bruce Wayne thing we joked about with him back in the day. So you've got that individual who may have the opportunity to come across some of this material. You then have on like the bad side of things, and again, just for talking sake, Lockheed Martin, who have intact craft. Is the danger that what we want is all the goodies that Lockheed Martin have and have been working on for decades and decades, that's making all this really fancy technology for war machines and new fiber optics and different forms of communication that's being sold to the highest bidder? If you start to mess about with it and say, well, private individuals are okay, we won't come and get your stuff, that'll be much more of a gentleman's agreement, if you want to say it that way. But the big sectors, we're taking all your stuff. Can they not just then use those loopholes and Lockheed start to say, well, actually, Mr. Lockheed is going to give it to Mr. Martin. And Mr. Martin, as a private individual, now owns a flying saucer. So Lockheed Martin no longer own this flying saucer. And that, it just starts to me, it waters down so much that it then just, and let's be fair, Dan, I was never confident with eminent domain passing, and I'm still not, that any private organization is still just going to willingly give up what they have because the government says so. I don't think that's how it works and has ever worked or will ever work, because these are organizations. Absolutely, you know, give me a hell yeah. So that's where I think that falls down. And even if it was totally black and white that everything has to be handed over, that's not going to happen. Where does it go from there then? If I'm right, just for talking sake, that it's going to have to be a compromise, Dan, isn't it just loophole central, population the private contractors?
Yeah, you're spot on. That's exactly it. If Lockheed wants to divulge itself of this material, as we've heard, then they can give enough information that it can be specified exactly what is being handed over, and then that narrows the scope down so that these private individuals aren't concerned. However, like you say, if Lockheed gives it to a private individual or wants to drag it through the courts for years, then they can do that by saying, well, how come Mr. Fugel doesn't have to hand over his exotic technology? Plus, aside from everything that we've said so far, what if when the material was found, you know, say in the 40s when Roswell happened or, you know, whatever crash, what if the lawmakers at that time signed an agreement that totally usurps all other laws and gave the legacy program carte blanche to do what they want? how do you undo that? They're not doing anything illegal. You can't strong arm them into doing something like that. Eminent domain also only applies to US companies. So these aerospace companies are international conglomerates now. So many different companies have been absorbed into them. And they're not necessarily, you know, they say they're American in the same way as, you know, I want to say Jaguar is still British. It's changed hands so many times. It's no longer, a British-owned company. So how do you strong-arm that company into giving it to you? It almost feels like peeing into the wind, right? We don't want to get caught in our own streams of pee. We don't want to get caught in the courts for years and years and years. We want a compromise that everyone's going to be happy with. And, you know, well, we've had 80 years of discussion on this. I feel we should be a bit more, we should be able to be a bit more subtle than just strong-arming thing, people into giving us the stuff. But it did make me think of, can you remember that show Debris, though it was all about the black market trade of UFO debris?
Yeah.
It reminded me of that, you know, kind of openly saying, yeah, if this has been happening all this time anyway, they're just putting on paper now to say, yeah, we can come steal your stuff if we want it back, kind of thing. But if it was given willingly and signed over to them within the law, then eminent domain wouldn't do anything anyway. So I think a little kind of bit of slowing down and shoring up that language, I think this is exactly the way to go.
Yeah. Remember, which Spider-Man is it that has Michael Keaton as the Vulture? No Way Home? Far From Home?
Yes, it was the first one.
Far From Home's in Europe.
Home Sweet Home.
No Way Home, yeah. Whichever one has Michael Keaton as a Vulture, who was wonderful in that. You know how that starts off?
Homecoming.
With the recovered... Homecoming, Spider-Man Homecoming, that's the one.
That's
so they've got the recovered tech, and the government essentially swoops in and says, we know you've got a contract to recover this stuff, but we're going to take it all, off you go. And he says, we've got a contract, and they're like, we don't care, bye, on you go.
Yep.
But they end up with a little bit of it left over, don't they? And yeah, it would be such a difficult operation. And like I said, back in the time when Ross Coulthart was mentioning that there is a building or a structure built over a downed craft that was discovered, even then, the stuff that isn't locked down as such would just get moved. These people would be well aware of it long before that happens. You know how when you watch an Ocean's 11 movie and when you see the ending and they do, here's what we're going to do, they've actually done it already, and that's the plot twist. Sorry to ruin Ocean's 11, folks, but essentially they have done it 2 days before you think they're going to do it, and that's how they get away with it. And they are two steps ahead. I would imagine any organization filled with non-human technology is three steps ahead of the US government, because they've got people who work there and tell them stuff and would know in advance. It's just not as easy, I think, as that eminent domain stuff passing. And bear in mind, this isn't me and Dan saying this is what we want. This is just, you know, realistically a way it might be working out.
Yeah.
I just don't know, Dan, if eminent domain is something that really bears any fruit anyway. And I genuinely think the only way that some of that stuff does come back over to hands that may progress things forward in a public setting would be if it was done voluntarily. And is that going to happen?
Yeah, exactly. We keep hearing that certain people want to give this material over. We hear that certain people don't. It's an arm wrestle. And it's just going to take a while to work out the subtlety of the situation. You know, things are never the extremes. They're always in the middle. And it's threading that needle through to get this material into a place where it can be transparently discussed instead of hidden.
Should we move on to something else that's potentially going to be transparently discussed, Dan?
Let's.
Yeah. New sponsor, Transparent Discussions? No. So David Grush, his op-ed is something that has been talked about quite a lot. Now, an op-ed, Dan, is just essentially an opinion piece, isn't it? In an article or a magazine not written by someone associated with that. So if I could write an op-ed in Time Magazine, pretty much, or BBC Astronomy Monthly, I could write an op-ed. David Grush is... I think at this point, I don't have to go into detail, but, you know, he came out and is a whistleblower on essentially working with classified materials and projects, briefing high-level politicians, presidents and whatnot on top secret programs. And he's come out and said he's seen enough material. And likely firsthand material that shows we have a non-human intelligence or knowledge of a non-human intelligence, etc., etc. Big news last year. His op-ed has been something that has been rumored for a while, potentially in a something like the Washington Post or the New Yorker. I think that's been rumored to be the potential outlet for that. I don't know if the New York Times has been noted, but we don't know yet. It seems to be something that can drop at any time. Over the last couple of weeks, there's been rumors, it's coming tomorrow, it's coming in 12 hours, and it's not happened. It seems to be that it's being reviewed in the same way secrets at Skinwalkers at the Pentagon, the Lou Elizondo book has to go through a review or a different process called DOPSR. It's being reviewed for security matters. There was rumors that it has to go through Arrow. Now, that's not the case for Lou Elizondo's book. That has nothing to do with Arrow. It's not being cleared by Arrow or anything like that. That's 100% correct. But the David Grush stuff, I don't see why that would have to go through Arrow either, do you?
Not necessarily. I mean, they could just be, because they're the UAP place now, it could be a case of they want Arrow to just give a cursory glance at it to make sure there's no kind of, you know, incriminating evidence or classified info they've come across in there. But ultimately, you're correct. What Grush did didn't involve Arrow necessarily. You know, it would have been AIMSOG around the time where Grush was kind of filing his whistleblower complaints through official channels. So it's odd that Arrow is even in the conversation here. And I think it was George Knapp that replied to the guy who found out. I want to say Ozarks Unbound on Twitter. He's a part of Askapol with Matt Laszlo, and he basically got a response from the DOD saying that this thing was with Arrow and it was being held up, if I'm correct. I think that's correct. So we could have a few scenarios here. It is delayed, clearly. Grush has been talking about it since December. It could be that Arrow is one of many places that they're waiting on approving it. It could be that Arrow is waiting on someone else to finish their review to pass it to them. So both of those scenarios fit Arrow is holding it up. However, George Knapp says that Arrow isn't holding it up. So something else is in play here. And you got to wonder if sometimes these things are held back for timing reasons, it seems. So I wonder if maybe it's just kind of being kept in the pocket, ready for a moment where, you know, he really needs to come out swinging. We've heard a few things from Askapol this week about hearings come in and things like that. So maybe they don't feel it's such an emergency right now to get that out.
Yeah, good point. And that kind of takes me on to what I was going to say, to be honest, that timing could be really important. Right now, would it get lost in the shuffle? Yeah, the UFO community would be all over it. Fantastic. But that's not really what we want this to have an impact on. You know, this is hopefully going to bring more into this. And I wonder, Dan, what do you expect to see from David Grush's op-ed? Personally, I don't see it being full of revelatory statements. I would imagine David Grush would keep those for a follow-up Joe Rogan interview, a 60 Minutes piece, something that's big and captures the imagination, not an opinion piece that's going to be read by a smaller section than, no doubt still a big section of the public, but a far smaller section than a live news broadcast would get, you know, 10 minutes on NBC, CNN, Fox, whatever it might be. Even News Nation, with the online presence they have managed to get, I just don't see an op-ed being a mini version of a Lou Elizondo book or having that expectation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, I would expect it to address low-hanging fruit, which is people think what Grush is saying, and we've heard Bill Nelson of NASA saying, Grush has a friend who said something about aliens. That's not the case. I feel like this op-ed would just be there to kind of clear up some of the claims and to perhaps give more of a seed to this stuff exists and here's how I know it exists. Once that's kind of out and hopefully kind of propagating a discussion of, you know, whatever David wants to include in the article, I think then elaborating on that becomes a kind of matter for hearings or, you know, to talk to politicians in the skiff. Like it or not, David Grush could tell you and I and everyone in the UFO community everything that he knows, and there's not a damn thing we can do about it. The only people that can do something about it are the officials with the right levers to pull. So everything's going to be aimed properly at them, you know? I'd love to see this op-ed appear somewhere like The Hill, to be honest, because then it is aimed at people on The Hill. And that's kind of who we need to be focused on messaging and talking to and affecting.
Yeah, even outside of it, and I've had a really busy few weeks, so even my keeping up to date with normal social media has not been the same. And I would normally see a lot of news from the US and the political stuff, the presidential campaigns and whatnot. So I'm even a little bit out of the loop with that. That's kind of, I'm back under control now with life, as work's kind of cleared up a little bit for the time being. So I'll get back on it. But there's still this presidential campaign going on, and a lot of news around that, like I say. So I just wonder, like you say, Dan, is timing key with this, that it's best being left in the run-up to hearings happening. I think that's a good place to move on to like you say, the work Askapol and Matt Laszlo and co have been doing has been pretty good recently as well. On that first one, so yeah, on the potential hearings, Tim Burchett, as we know, has been a big speaker of the UFO topic and championing it in his day-to-day life. Askapol asked, did he feel the conversation that Tim Burchett had with Speaker Mike Johnson resonated regarding UAP? And Tim Burchett said, very much so. He wrote it down. That's a big thing with Johnson. If he writes it down, it's hit. And I just need to follow up. Obviously, we've got everything else going on in that oversight committee. And by that, Matt Laszlo clears up that the President Joe Biden impeachment inquiry is being run through that same committee. So right now, I imagine UFOs, let's call them what they are, call a spade, is on the slight back burner with everything else going on that's happening in US politics. And that's fair. So right now, don't throw all your best material out when it's going to potentially not stick a landing.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have to remember, you know, Burchett has been speaking to Mike Johnson for a while now, since he, you know, got the job as Speaker of the House. And apparently Johnson was supportive of the UFO issue way back then as well. And it turned out
day
that
one,
he was
pretty much, yeah, day one. Yeah.
You know, supposedly stopped the Schumer Rounds Act. So we've got a bit of an arm wrestle between perception going here, you know. Like, I love that Burchett added that, oh, well, he wrote it down. That means that he's paying attention. Yeah, sure. Did Burchett see where he was writing? Was he just drawing pictures, writing lol? Or was he actually, you know, making notes to action? This is all in the future, and we'll find out when we find out. They've spoken about field hearings again, that they don't need permission to do them. We've heard this for a while now. I kind of like to see some forward momentum on it instead of just talking about it. Yeah, just a little blue in the face hearing them talking about it. Let's get moving, you know?
And I get from a political point of view as well, in the middle of all these election campaigns and re-election campaigns, if you down tools on all the other matters going on and jump into a field hearing about UFOs, perception, you know, the optics might not be great on that for a lot of voters. And, you know, long term, there's maybe a better game to be played here in that. So that makes sense. On that, Askapol also had spoken to Representative Luna and Gates, and they said they had been briefed. Well, Askapol had a source that told them they had been briefed by people that had a video of bodies. The inquiry was, are those current military folks? Askapol asked, and the answer from the source was yes. Matt Gates confirmed that he had a briefing with Representative Luna. No comment on the comments or contents of the briefing at this time. And Representative Luna, when asked about the briefing and did you see bodies, she said, I cannot discuss these things, you know that. I'm sure we'll have field hearings, no comment. So that was kind of, that's that. Bodies, Dan, one of Drowning Pool's biggest hits back in the day.
I made the floor.
But it's, yeah, that's huge though, isn't it? You know, if they are, and this is the problem, it's a big if, and I don't doubt Matt Laszlo's sources, but right now it's a source coming out and saying they've seen bodies in a video. For you, what are you thinking? Is this potentially a video like the fake Virginia one that leaked recently? Are they seeing stuff that's actually legitimate? Is it here's something that might be of interest, or are they being shown something of here's definitive proof and here's why you should keep doing what you're doing? Where do you sit with it?
Yeah, I've tried to kind of separate the claims out on what's useful in Matt Laszlo telling us this. You know, yes, Luna said no comment because it is literally against the law for us to tell them what was spoken about in the skiff. And just like you say, what video? Like, it's purported to be non-human intelligence. Yeah. It would fit the bill if someone currently in the military showed them Jaime Masoan's video of the mummies from Peru, you know, like that would fit the bill. I'm not saying that's what it was, but it would fulfill the kind of remit. However, the highlight here for me is that we thought that those conversations were pretty conservative, pretty nuts and bolts driven, just about craft in the sky, mm-hmm. videos, things like that. However, now we found out they were talking about bodies. The fact that that part of the conversation is even on the table, to me, means they're a lot further along in their conversation, hearing things that are just a bit deeper than I expected. And that's really exciting because it makes you wonder what else they've been talking about. Like I say, it doesn't confirm that the video of the bodies is real, but what it does do is tell us that they're having the conversation about them, which we didn't know before.
Yeah, I think it's one thing if I'm a high-ranking politician, like a Gates, like a Luna, like a Burchett. I know Burchett wasn't there, as we can see, but if they're in one of those briefings and you see a video of some pretty cool tech flying about, that can be one thing, okay? Or it could be many things. But if you're in a briefing and someone shows you a video that is purportedly non-human body, that's pretty paradigm shift, altering, whatever you want to call it. I'm not a big fan of that phrase, honestly, but you know, that's pretty life-changing.
Mind-blowing
stuff.
That's what it means, and, right? It's a part.
Yeah, mind-blowing. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's wow. That's life-defining. That's something you remember, and that would surely drive these folks on to go, do you know what? I'm not letting this go. I've just seen an alien. You know, that's it. That for them is going to hopefully be enough to get the bit between their teeth. Someone on that, Dan, another Ask a Paul news item which bleeds into that was Senator Gillibrand has come out with a statement recently, again to Ask a Paul. She said, "I'm very concerned about UAPs, particularly drone technology, aircraft technology that is constantly around our military sites." Senator Gillibrand went on to say, "It's a form of ubiquitous surveillance that causes great concern for me." Senator Gillibrand seemed to jump in at the deep end and very quickly get out the pool on the other side, saying the water was too cold, didn't she? And now seems to have dipped her toe back in. I still get the feeling Senator Gillibrand, from a public point of view at least, is looking to talk about this subject in the way that we're not talking aliens, we're not talking non-human intelligence, we're talking some advanced technology that probably or could be from another country. Is that the sense you get from her?
Yeah, she seems, you know, early on she was talking about anomalous stuff, things that were a little more outside of the wheelhouse of what we expect. Now she's talking about, you know, drones and things like that. And, you know, let's be clear, when you say drone, it doesn't mean human drone. Like, there's still room in that for it to be an extraterrestrial drone or a non-human intelligence drone or something like that. But she's clearly very focused on the military part of it, and is kind of toeing the line in terms of staying within the bounds of the laws that have passed in previous years, the legislation that's passed in previous years. I'm really curious what it looks like once this election has passed, if she's going to, you know, kind of go a bit faster or, you know, deeper on it. But I think part of this is, you know, being every day and doing this as well, we forget that there's still stigma out there. You know, you and I are fine talking about it. Mm. People listening to this are fine talking about it. We can have those conversations. But you talk to someone who isn't familiar with this, and instantly you're talking about aliens. And it doesn't matter how hard you try and pull them back to the space of this stuff in the sky that we just don't know what it is. Let's figure it out. They keep on with the aliens thing. I literally had an exchange with someone the other day where they told me I thought aliens were responsible. And I was like, no, I don't know. Like, I just don't know. And then they insisted that I thought aliens were responsible. So there's a definite stigma still attached, and the subject is still associated with aliens and ET and things like that. So people like Gillibrand, I can understand why they're tiptoeing, because to them, it could kind of be political kryptonite if this turns out to, you know, if it becomes a conversation about the mummies or something like that that turns out to be a fake, that's it. Their career's over. Whereas if they're constantly talking about safety, you know, air security, things like that, they're things that they can say, well, you know, I never discussed aliens and all those kind of outlandish parts that they think are outlandish. So I understand her being conservative about it, but I wish that the election wasn't happening so that we could get, you know, these masks removed. And I feel like you know, when you have a job and you have a mystery shopper come in, I feel like that's the situation we're in at the moment. Mm-hmm. Everyone's just watching everyone else politically to make a wrong move so they can exploit it. So everyone's just trying to behave.
Yeah, I think back at the start, the UFO community and Kirsten Gillibrand went on a date. And at the end of that date, we were all a bit drunk and said we love each other straight away. And then Senator Gillibrand turned up on the second date and stone cold sober, walked things back and said, let's take this slowly. And friend zoned us, basically.
I love it. That's a good analogy.
I'm not too sure where that's going to go. But yeah, maybe we have to move on and, you know, swipe right on someone else. Is it swipe right? Swipe left? I don't know. I never used Tinder.
Swipe something.
Listen, it was plenty of fish back in the day. So for me anyway, yeah, long before I met the wife, just to clear that up in case anyone says, isn't Andy married? Yeah, Tinder wasn't even a thing. So God, that ages me. But speaking of good fish analogies, Dan, there was a really good one on Two of the Stars Top. So TTS Talks reappeared with episode 12. So To the Stars Talks is Tom DeLonge's To the Stars Academy. Now To the Stars, just To the Stars now, isn't it?
Just To the company. Stars.
And this is their podcast. Back in the day, it kicked off with an episode with Lou Elizondo, and it was going to be a three-part series. Chris Mellon appeared, Joe Sherman, who was part of that back in the day, and they have also had Steve Justice, I'm just looking at Hal Puthoff, and Peter Lavenda's been on it, talking about Secret Machines, and episode 12 kind of dropped. There's not been a lot of rhyme or reason to episode releases. Put it this way, you've had June 2020, then it was July, then it jumps to April 2022, May 2022, and then February of this year. So they're pretty fast and loose as to when they actually release anything, but thought it was pretty interesting. Jim Semivan taking on hosting duties here and asking Tom DeLonge the questions. Just some key takeaways, Dan, that we've got from this one. I know we've both listened to it. The episode was titled The Phenomena, Science, Religion, and Consciousness with Tom DeLonge and Jim Semivan. Kicked off Monsters, I've done it already. Is it Monsters in California or Monsters of California?
It's Monsters of California.
And I've wrote in, but I know it's of. I've got the hoodie.
it's Sex and the City, wear it, actually. So,
don't start. So Monsters of California, he said he wanted to inspire wonder where the movie takes in demonic possession, Bigfoot, UFOs, orbs, and he wanted to say, you know, all of these are real, that kind of stuff we know. And he had a really nice analogy, Dan, and this is what I wanted to get to, where he's talking about how this journey into the UFO topic and how all these things can be intertwined. And he talked about the ocean and how when you look at the ocean, you see a whale, a fish and a shark, and you see they're all in the ocean and you think, ah, those things live there. That makes sense. Then a can of Coke floats by, which makes no sense. So you follow the can of Coke. That seems alien almost. And that leads you to a boat. And what's a boat? What's a boat doing with the ocean? It interacts in a different way than the fish do. You follow the boat and that takes you to an island. And now you've got a whole new dynamic where you had this water world filled with creatures. You then have an alien piece of, you know, something, trash, as we're calling it here, that leads you to something else, to something else, to something else. And all of a sudden, you're that spider diagram is just changed completely. And he says how all these things are very different, but they cross paths depending on the time, the place. He says in terms of the UFO subject, you know, it could even be things like the minerals that are built into the area, you know, what kind of ore is under the ground, talks about Skinwalker Ranch, physics, maths, and all that good stuff. Tom DeLonge was on form here, and the way Tom DeLonge goes off on one when he gets asked a question.
One of the highlights for me of this overall was thinking about how Tom used to speak, you know, comparing it to his appearance on Joe Rogan, for example, comparing how he spoke
the
then
one that was
to
about
how
cluster,
he's speaking now.
Cluster yeah. Friends.
and he speaks so well on it now. You know, like he juggles a lot of possibilities. He talks about the kind of lofty things still, but he says, I don't know a lot. And he lets that be a conversation as opposed to claiming to know and that claiming that, you know, certain videos are real. And he credits Semivan and, you know, people like Elizondo for talking to him in the way they did, for advancing the way that he speaks about it. But it really kind of jumped out to me here about how he talks about these things. And let's be honest, like there are some really lofty things here. You know, the Coke can analogy is great. You know, I know it's one that we talk about often, you know, with the ocean and life in it. But Tom was talking about frequency. He was talking about the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit and religion and how they all kind of seem to come down to the same place. One of the excellent things that jumped out to me, and I know that a lot of people talk about, you know, how much truth is in Secret Machines, for example. And here, Semi Van explains that he had Secret Machines flagged to him. And Tom explains that he actually put that together without the help of his advisors. And they just realized he was onto something. Tom and AJ put it all together. So that for me is a bit of a change from what I thought before listening. I don't know. And it makes me think of when Danny Sheehan talks, right? You hear things and they seep into it. So it might not be that someone gave him a list of facts to include, but it might be that a couple of conversations with a couple of people kind of seeped into the work in that way, you know? They also address that kind of original group of advisors. 8 original advisors. One was outed in WikiLeaks. Jim Semivan apparently gets 2, and they were very senior people, and Tom has never told people who they were. So Tom's bearing out as someone that's really trustworthy and can speak about this subject really, really well. And I love that because Blink, I don't know how many people listening follow Blink-182. They just kind of broke records and are the longest kind of running single on the alternative charts in the USA. And they got to number one after being, you know, years away. All of this stuff means more people are talking to Tom, means he's talking about UFOs more. And this is kind of what we're here for, right? Is to have these conversations. No one really has the answers, it seems, but we can have the conversation in sensible ways. Jim even speaks to Tom about changes in his worldview on UAP, and Tom comes up with three points. He said in the early days...
Can we get to that in a minute? Because I've got mine in like kind of like order, okay?
Oh, perfect.
Just before we get there. I'll skip a couple of them.
Wait.
There was a lot of talk before that.
I was just going to say, earlier on, this was during the Monsters of Cali talk, where two things that I really loved. One was that, you know, making the point that the US government aren't necessarily the bad guy. It's made up of a lot of different people. There are soccer moms that, you know, are leaving work to go. Is that what you're going to say?
Literally, yeah. Moms work in the back office of the Pentagon, do the school run, go to soccer practice, and then go to work. Yeah.
People forget. People forget, and it's worth remembering, you know, the US government are out to get you. Are they just trying to get to work and, you know, get through their task for the day and then go home? It's not a homogenous.
Not to say there are bad people. There are dickheads and arseholes and evil folks 100%. That work at these places, very powerful, ego-tripping folks, but there are just your standard, normal, everyday folks who are sealing envelopes and doing coffee runs and, you know, turning up late to work and just being stressed because their kid threw a paddy in the back of a car first thing in the morning and then having to go and deal with some high-ranking official. You know, that happens in every walk of life. So, yeah, spot on.
Yeah, that was a great point. And then the other part that I loved from kind of that section of the talk was Tom comparing giving humans a UFO to giving a cow an iPhone. And he kind of explains, you know, that if you want to talk to the cow about the App Store, for example, how do you talk about the App Store without explaining everything else that kind of has to come with that device? You don't just talk about the device. You've got to talk about Wi-Fi, you know, an invisible network that you can pick up signal from. If you don't know that exists, that's like, another
kind of... What is a device?
Yeah, exactly. And part of me feels like it's no accident that in 2001, A Space Odyssey, the thing that was teaching humanity to kind of progress forward was a giant black slab, which is just an iPhone. It's an iPad. It's a, you know, it's a bank of knowledge. And this knowledge kind of seeds a certain way of thinking. And you've got to wonder if that seeding is being done intentionally to make us develop in a certain way. And that comes up in the conversation here. By the way, I'm not saying the ET gave us iPhones. Just to be specific, just that the very act of appearing seems to inspire us to go down a certain technological path.
Yeah, I'll come to something in a second, kind of intertwined a little bit. And maybe not, I might be talking absolute shit. There's a lot of talk about deception of outside forces influencing us on a human level. If you've heard Tom DeLonge talk on multiple occasions, a lot of what's said is kind of running in, with the theme, free will being an illusion, is choice real, fights for the soul, all that kind of stuff comes up. However, something came up, Dan, and I remember writing this. I was in work when I'd done this, right? And I was sitting making my notes on lunch. And I remember thinking I should go back and rewrite these. So if this doesn't make sense, I'll sit and waffle on. But you'll get what I mean. So the idea that these craft, or whatever they are coming here to abduct and investigate us, I've put, like, why now in this time period? Surely you could go to an easier time. And this is with Tom DeLonge talking about these things coming. He seems to really lean in, they're coming from a different time almost, okay? Or they have some manipulation of time. You could go back and take cavemen or folks from the Victorian era when we were less technologically advanced. Surely our technology wouldn't make a difference. So for me, it makes sense what these things are doing is more of an ongoing investigation rather than something they're coming here now to check us out now and where we are now. And that's not necessarily something Tom was getting at. It seemed he seemed to focus on the idea that they could be coming here now for a reason, that we have to be at this point in our advancement, our technological advancement, our spiritual advancement for the hacking of souls and stuff. But I just thought, it just made me think, Dan, and what do you think on that? That these things, or some of these things potentially come here, and it seems more like an ongoing investigation of the human being or human species.
Yeah, absolutely. I get to talk about Keel, and I love that. They brought it up.
Well, have you read Keel recently, Dan?
So Operation Trojan Horse was Keel's book, and in that he kind of lays out a lot of high strangeness, and reflecting back on it, has the idea that he's not just being shown things randomly, that actually he's being dragged through an educational process. And once you kind of get to a certain place, you can advance in the class. So if we look back, 200 years, say, and you've got those airship sightings, really weird airship sightings where, you've got airships that are dropping anchors and people are coming off them, or beings are coming off them in diving suits, and they're climbing down the chain and moving as if they're underwater. And it's almost like, okay, so you understand this. You understand that you're just in a medium, like fish are in the ocean and they don't know what water is, but we have air and we don't really understand the medium of the vacuum of space, for example. We now think that it's quantum and possibility, space-time need not apply. But we don't know what that medium that we're in is. And it was, Keel proposes that it's almost like they're letting you know a certain part of the phenomena so that you understand it. Then you can progress to the next class. However, not everyone kind of understands and learns at the same rate. So this has to be a really long running kind of almost a psyop, right? To acclimatize people to the weirder aspects of the universe. And when I say weirder for us, it's all relative. These things are just normal. We just don't understand them yet. So that kind of thing, the idea of it being an educational effort, is really curious, because in modern day, we have these communication systems that let you and I do this and talk to people about it. And, we can share our weird experiences. And as you see with UFO Twitter, everyone with these experiences kind of groups up, right? We find our tribe, so to speak. And the subject has never been more popular. It's never been easier to talk about this subject with people, and to find people that will talk about it with you instead of just, having eyes rolled at you in your everyday life by people that aren't interested. So I wonder if, and I think you asked Randall Nickerson this when you spoke to him about the aerial school. You wonder if those events are given to people who are on the cusp of this kind of information age, and now they're old enough to be able to vocalize it in a non-sensational way, or in a sensible way, or, leaving off a lot of the speculative stuff. That's a plus, right? To be able to vocalize that story. A lot of people, when the phenomenon came out, their favorite part of that whole thing was the aerial section. And it's just, you got to wonder, is James, is Randall, are all the experiences talking about their experiences in the modern day through this worldwide communication network that we have, you know, posting it on TikTok and things like that. Is that why we're seeing the uptick now? Or are we kind of closer than ever to having the class, you know, to the bell going and saying, school's out, go into space and meet us, you know? Or is it a case of we're still very much kind of in the process? Something that stands out in the Keel stuff as well is that he talks about it leading us down a path to a belief system. And I don't think it's controversial to say that in the modern day, as many religious people as there are on the planet, religion is kind of on the downward trend, right? And when I say religion, I mean Catholicism and things like that. And what we kind of have is a growing kind of apathy towards it, not necessarily atheism, but apathy, like religion, whatever, you know, it's just another thing. Whereas in this subject, we have a bunch of people who believe, who have faith in ETs coming here. So just like Diana Pasulka says, this is almost a religion in itself. So is it a religion that is being seeded so that we believe in the sky people again, in the star people, as the, you know, the indigenous folk of Australia and the Native Americans and tribes all over the world is telling us? I don't know, but it's stupidly interesting, right?
Yeah, one of the things I struggle with a little bit, and it's one of those when you take a step back and look at, you answer a question like that, and yeah, it makes sense. So you take a step back to the kind of real world, and I think, how are the millions of people in Africa or India or Asia or anywhere in the world who are starving and have no money and no technology, mm-hmm. and, you know, all the atrocities happening, how are they being prepared for that? I think some of this stuff seems really easy from a Western point of view to be like, oh yeah, well, aliens are prepping us now for disclosure. Are they? Because it seems aliens are preparing a very small amount of us for disclosure, while the rest, you know, to hell with them. And that's not the aliens' problem, but maybe then that answers my own question by saying that as a species, until we are on a more level playing field with each other and are nicer, but things don't seem to be going that way as a planet, does it?
No, I think part of that is to do with, you know, when I was in Mexico, I would hear about all these different experiences that people had, but they wouldn't call them UFOs. They would say they were ancestor spirits and things like that. Mm. So you got to wonder if there's a kind of a localized facet to this of, you know, the phenomena will show you what it shows you. And in America, it's highly technological. It's all military. And so you get incursions into military areas by weird things. Whereas Mexico or somewhere like India, you know, it's religion based, and there's a kind of different approach that would be taken there. And you're kind of targeting your audience, right? You're changing your message for the audience. Mm. And that's a sensible thing to do in any kind of, you know, presentation and things like that. There was a part of this where Tom brings up the fact that, you know, sometimes in these horrible experiences, when people think they're being abducted, they'll, you know, invoke the name of Jesus and the experience will stop. But equally, they will just say, nah, in a non-religious way, and it will also just stop. So it doesn't seem to be associated with religion per se. It seems to be needing our permission in some way, shape, or form to go through these experiences. So, you know, even though I'm kind of saying religion here, I don't think that's the linchpin of this. But you're also absolutely right. You know, we're off kilter as a planet. What we think of as the world is not how the rest of the world is. You know, even in America, there are people that live in the middle of nowhere and would have to travel 8 hours to get to school. And, you know, how would they learn about this kind of stuff? I wonder if, you know, there's this wonderful quote in Contact. Spoilers for anyone that hasn't watched it, go watch it. It's an incredible movie. But right at the end, when the main character meets the non-human intelligence, he says to her, you're an interesting species, an interesting mix. You're capable of such beauty, such beautiful dreams, and such horrible nightmares. You feel so lost, so cut off, so alone. Only you're not. See, in all our searching, the only thing we found that makes the emptiness bearable is each other. This was a first step. In time, you'll take another. This is the way it's been done for billions of years. Small moves, Andy. Small moves. He doesn't say Andy. He says Ellie. But, you know, I think that's
worth
bearing.
I was going to say, yeah, I don't remember her name being Andy.
Just in the special edition, it's Andy. But tiny moves, you know, it's that like little bit of seed in, little bit of impression, and then eventually we're going to get to a place where we just accept that we're not alone, sight unseen, and we operate in a bit more of a, when I say global, I don't mean, or universal manner, you know, we're going to say, how are we represented in space to another species? What foot do we want to put forward? And right now we're arguing over the space station, there are wars, there's genocide. And yeah, there's too much of a discrepancy between each country on Earth that you couldn't just appear in the sky in one way, right?
Yeah.
Made me think of that great Christopher Eccleston series. You remember the, I forget what it was called, we spoke about it before, where the guy disappears and he comes back and he's the son of a
second coming,
I think that's it. Where, you know, he comes back and says, I am, you know, God's son. And everyone's like, oh, bullshit, you know, prove it. How would you prove something to the whole planet? Like, he manages to do something in the series. I won't spoil it for people.
He goes,
watch it.
He goes to the... I don't mind spoiling that one because I think it's quite cool. He goes to a football stadium and he makes a beam of light appear in like the center circle
and
from
they can't
the sky,
find a source,
and that gets enough attention. Yeah.
Yeah. So you kind of have to peacock in a way. And there's not really... I mean, we can see even when a UFO video gets released, not everyone agrees on what it is, right? Even if it's just anomalous, there's such discussion and people take it in different ways. And as a sport fan, even you know that a tackle on the edge of the box, people can see that event in different ways. Some people think it's a penalty. Some people think it's not. Even when you go to VAR and the slow motion cameras, there's still a debate about it. And there's no objective
after
truth,
this
right?
weekend. After this weekend in Scottish football, Dan, you've got no idea what you've just said there. So, yeah.
Well,
I'll,
but there
I'll
you
not
go.
Even get into that one because I'll start to get hate mail.
I'm just going to say it was a goal.
But yeah, to bring it back to what you said, Dan. Yeah, Dan doesn't, and anyone listening to this of a persuasion who knows who I support will know why I'm staying out of it. Yeah.
But that's a fairly
by the end of it,
innocuous, harmless thing that people don't agree on. And if we can't agree on that, how could we agree on a sign from above or a sign from an ET species definitively showing us that that's what they are? We wouldn't. It takes time. So small steps.
I'm going to make a comment that only is relevant to a very small group of people, but Tom DeLonge is the John Beaton of the UFO subject. And Tom DeLonge says he has three different major points of understanding, Dan, and this is what you were mentioning before. I'll put my bastardized version of it out and then you can clear it up. So he says when he first came to the UFO subject, you know, it was these things come from other planets and essentially they want a resource. You know, that's a pretty simplified way of thinking. He then took a step to it being these are non-human intelligences coming from time. The universe isn't what we think. And a third where he is now, he believes whatever this is rapidly advancing our DNA so they can inhabit this place, essentially hacking our souls in a way that they can be here. These non-human intelligences are trying to hack our system, and I'm thinking of it as sort of taking over our avatars, that it's a socially engineered planet for pain. That was pretty much what I got from those.
Interesting. So I've just looked at John Beaton, and that's a hilarious reference, by the way. I love it.
Skip past that. Skip past it. It's not worth it.
But really exemplary of what, you know, I was saying. And yeah, we speak about changes in our worldview on UAP often, and the idea that they're coming from time and that time is, I think Tom says, it's parallel and it's just separated by frequency, makes me think of, you know, interlocking snowflakes, you know, like no two snowflakes are the same, but they could fit together and you could have like a jillion of them that all kind of make up a solid, like a snowball, you know. The DNA point is really interesting because when you have kids, there's a chance that they'll get DNA from dad, but the DNA they do get, guaranteed, is the ancestral DNA from mum. And this is the DNA that in that kind of conversation between nurture and nature, you know, is your biology defining to your character, or is it more that mum and dad have an impression and your friends have an impression and define who you are? It's a bit of both, but it's interesting to think about that ancestral DNA as being something which carries over and carries forward, because that ancestral DNA, it lets you, you know, I mean, someone might write in and say, I'm totally wrong here, but that's the kind of thing that, you know, when a fish comes out and it can just swim and a bird comes out and it figures out how to fly and there's no communication, no one's showing it how to fly. It just kind of knows that's coded into this part of the DNA. So if we're passing that along, and this has been an effort, an educational effort over thousands, millions of years to kind of indoctrinate us or to get us used to them being here, or even if they're affecting that DNA to be a certain way, it's kind of a genius way of doing it, because we don't necessarily consciously know. We're only just kind of starting to understand DNA as a thing, as an information carrier. And you could talk about it for about 80 hours. Definitely try and find someone who knows DNA like the back of their hand and interview them, because it's fascinating. And a part of me wonders, you know, every form of life here on Earth is made from DNA. DNA is the thing that feels out evolution. It changes, it mutates, it gives all these different species their different attributes. So it's curious to think of DNA as maybe something that arrived here via panspermia, you know, an asteroid carrying a bit of something and crashing on Earth. Do we then look at DNA as a life form that's here kind of dictating and changing us into something that can interact with different levels of reality? And what I mean by that is, you know, a fish interacts with the world differently to what us interacting with the world, just because we have different tools like eyes and ears and the ability to mm-hmm. see underwater or breathe underwater. So it kind of dictates your environment. So I think that's fascinating to think about, and it really kind of turns my brain to dribble when I get too much into it.
Yeah, a really silly thing that I always look at is, like, my last dog was a Border Terrier and this dog's a Border Terrier. And I would always look at my last dog, and when he would do a wee, he would, like, kick the grass up behind him to, like, cover it up.
Sure.
I never taught him that, but he would do it. And the dog I've got now, totally different dog, never knew the last dog. I take Eddie out for a walk, he pees, and he kicks the grass up to cover his wee. Again, I've never showed him that. That would be really weird if I was out taking a piss outside and covering it up. But, you know, that's just built in. That's what they do. It's an instinct. And it's easy to go, well, it's an instinct, they just do it. Yeah, but where does that come from? That's got to be programmed in somewhere through something that, you know, has evolved over centuries and millennia. So that kind of stuff, yeah, is quite interesting. And just to say on that one, he mentioned off the last kind of point I've got, Dan, was one thing, all of this, he tries to always be positive at the end, I think, Tom DeLonge, as much as what he says can come across as worrying or negative or playing on the negative, that, you know, and a lot of it is quite troubling when you really look at it. One of the thing about all of this is, to our benefit, is a sort of unity of everyone. It's a bit blue sky and wishy-washy, but regardless of religion, if people meditate, pray, whatever you want to call it, then as a species we can spiritually evolve our consciousness. I know some of that talk isn't for everyone, Dan, and isn't everyone's bag, but it's kind of what you've touched on there, the idea that, you know, if everyone can actually get together, Tom basically says, you know, and other people have said the same thing, not Tom's not exclusive to this, you have a collective superpower of consciousness and good thoughts, and these things can really, really make a difference, which I think on a sense or on a level is true.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting you say that about the terms and the language we use, because I feel like the language can kind of lock people out sometimes of the conversation.
Sure, 100%, 100%.
Time is a frequency. We're going to evolve our consciousness. Sounds like bullshit, right? Whereas if I say to you, oh, there's a possibility that time doesn't flow one direction. It could flow another way or move differently, depending on if you're bored or if you're happy, or, you know, if you even got a clock to look at. A dog doesn't understand a clock. How does it experience time when you go to work?
Dan, you've done it in this discussion about 20 minutes ago when I said I don't like the term paradigm shift. You like said blows my mind. Yeah, that's it.
Exactly.
Yeah. One thing one person, the way someone speaks to you, I could roll my eyes and be like, oh, I'm just totally switched off from this person. So yeah, exactly the same.
Yeah. So when we say, I like to kind of dig into these terms and be like, okay, what are we actually trying to say with that? And when we say raising our consciousness, it usually just means people being more compassionate and nicer, a bit more aware of the world, how your actions affect other people. That is what they would call a higher consciousness level, right? And that's a lot more stomach palatable if you say to someone, you know, just be nicer and we'll be nicer as a planet and we'll be more conscious of other countries and how all the systems, like the weather systems around the planet, connect. That's something that we're doing right now, talking about climate change. You know, these little actions have these big impacts. And we think about that now, whereas 100 years ago, we didn't really. So say and raise our consciousness is a way of talking about that. So that language is stuff that we kind of have to find so that we can have these conversations, I think. But one part from the end that I really loved was Tom brought up Kolaris and the fact that people were injured there. And I think it was off the bat of Sammy Van asking, do you feel happy or scared or optimistic? And Tom brought up Kolaris and speaking about these negative effects. And we have to remember the things that are happening there might not be malicious on purpose. You know, they might not just be, you know, zapping us. For all we know, that's their handshake. And them trying to shake their hand zaps us with electricity. So we get burned and we think it's attacking us, you know? We have to kind of think outside the box in these ways. But it certainly seems, and Tom sums it up at the end there, he says, we seem to have something they don't, and we can beat them with our superpower, which is consciousness. Again, kind of wishy-washy, but I think it's just our ability to talk to each other, to empathize with each other, to understand each other. That is something that we don't necessarily see in all animal species. And to go back to that DNA kind of thing, what if some of our ancestral DNA is still really basic? And it means that some people don't care about other forms of life. Whereas you and I, with other people, we love animals. We'd never hurt an animal, you know? That seems to be a characteristic that people have or don't. Except cats, yeah. Someone's going to yell. I like cats. I'm just allergic, so I have to stay away from them.
Yeah, I said that before, didn't I, again, about cats. So yeah, I don't dislike cats. Some of them are okay. They're just a bit boring. But yeah, not a cat person. So yeah, it was a pretty interesting episode. Nice to see it back, and probably 2 years till the next one at this rate, Dan, yeah.
Yeah, but great, great conversation. And like everything we've covered here is really lofty conversation. I'd recommend if you want to dive further into kind of the more esoteric side of what we were saying about with DNA, or sorry, not to put words in your mouth, what I was saying about DNA, go read The Cosmic Serpent. Quite an old book, but it just talks about the idea that a lot of ancient kind of tribes and religions have a serpent at the center of their mythology, and that serpent seems to represent DNA when you look into it. Fascinating book. Would highly recommend reading it.
Just fly through for the last couple of minutes, Dan, very quickly. There's some listeners' questions, but also the Canadian government has a UFO UAP report, quote unquote, coming out in the coming months, doesn't it? And some of the reports of this online are, I see people getting a little bit excited, but I think you put it quite right before, Dan, what it's sort of going to be like, and I'll let you take that one because it was your words.
So it's going to be the same as the NASA panel, right? They're not looking at whether ET exists. That's not what this report is going to say. It's the impetus for the whole project is to look at how is data collected? Where is it kept? Can they do a better job of doing this so they can analyze it better? Yes, yes, and yes to all those things. But they're formally going through that process. So what's likely to be in the report is a bunch of identifications for systems that don't quite work as we want them to work right now, and some proposals to make them better going forward. There was an interesting comment from the head of the project, whose name escapes me right now, but she said that there's some intriguing or curious things in the historical aspect. And I know we're waiting for Arrow's historical report. So I wonder if there's a little crossover there between Canada and America and some UAP case that they both dealt with together. I know last year they both worked on UAP 23. Whatever that incident was, we don't know. So I'm hoping that there'll be a few tidbits in there, but by and large, it's just going to be, you know, a technical appraisal of their ability to collect information. That's it.
Excellent. And I've nothing to add to that. It is what it is, and Dan said it well. Dan, a couple of listener questions to kind of round off. Tim Nobley asked, it said there are dozens of whistleblowers started the process of blowing their whistles. Can you explain what the process is, or would that be too involved? Who do they report to, and is there a chance their information gets released to the public? I know really basically, Dan, that whistleblowers are folks in this case, because I've got whistleblowing processes in the organization I work for, obviously not to the level that we're talking about with a David Grush or the individuals in the background there, but essentially you're looking at people coming forward who have evidence of wrongdoing, or they feel wrongdoing in their organization, and they report it through a process, and it's decided whether there is, if wrongdoing's happening, action can be taken off the back of that. In this case, is parts or aspects of the US government covering up ongoing non-human intelligence or alien interaction, essentially, is what we're looking at here. Is that right, Dan? Yeah?
Yeah, that's pretty spot on. You know, every organization within the US government has a whistleblower department. You can complain to them about specific things. You know, if you go to them and tell them, oh, I'm afraid that they're hiding ET bodies, there's probably not much they can do. Whereas, like David Grush, if you go to the Inspector General, who is kind of outside of all those organizations and looks at them overall, and say, hey, these people are making my life harder because I've said XYZ, that's something they can act on. And they can check whether that is happening, and then they can hold their feet to the fire. There is a specific process to go through for the whistleblowers. And I would say to people, not to be like, oh, just go Google it, but just chuck whistleblower US into Google and it will take you to the Inspector General whistleblower page, which details what you can complain about, how you can complain, and the kind of process going forward of what that would look like. We've essentially seen David Grush use that whistleblower process, and everything that's kind of come out of it with the Inspector General complaint being brought out and shown to us, so at least to officials, that's kind of part and parcel of this process. There's a process there. They have to follow it. It's why David Grush can't run 100 miles an hour and just kind of tell us everything that he knows. That there are channels and means to do this.
Yeah, and the idea that will information be released to the public, I think there are elements of it that may be able to come out, and that's very much what David Grush is trying to get pushed through at the moment. Dave Smethurst similarly asks, do we think the delays on David Grush's op-ed is because it has some pretty hard to get out revelations? One rumour is he'll be talking about what the NSA satellites in orbit have picked up and recorded. Not going to lie, I would love if David Grush in his op-ed or in the future talks about UFOs picked up on NSA satellites, because that would be pretty cool.
Yeah, same. That would be really interesting. The stuff that we know about, like even when NASA puts a satellite up to image the Earth, 9 times out of 10, it's a hand-me-down from the NSA, because their capabilities and their budget is just bigger than what NASA can do. So they have some incredible technology. And yeah, it'd be great if we could kind of hear about them coming from space and, you know, coming from other places, the implication is there, right? Or whether they're just trying to look that way. Chris Mellon touched on it. It hasn't really been touched on since. So that'd be really cool. In terms of what it's rumored to contain, the rumors, you know, don't put too much stock in them, because you'll just end up disappointed. Big hype, big letdown. That's how it always goes. So just let the plate spin and we'll see it when we see it.
Yeah, and Dave, we sort of touched on the next question about the eminent domain stuff within, I built that in for you and what we chatted about, so thank you. Someone asked Kimberly on YouTube, so hello Kimberly, if you're watching or listening, to discuss the Ashton Forbes MH370 stuff. I still don't think there's anything there that I'm getting a bit bunged up. Not emotional, just a cold. anything there worth digging into? I know some folks seem really adamant that it's not been debunked. Others seem really adamant that it has been. I think I'm just sitting out in the background going, yeah, I don't see enough in this for me to have an interest at this point still. But Godspeed with anyone who is still kicking the shit out of that dead horse, so to speak, because it's just, yeah, it's not, I don't see it going anywhere, and it's just not one I want to get involved in, to be honest. So, see, especially when you still see the families have got ongoing action suits, you know, to try and find out where their almost definitely deceased relatives' bodies are. Yeah, I just don't see there being too much to it, honestly. And again, I get we're talking about people who have probably passed away, but I would love for there to be something spectacular, like a video like that, to be real and genuine. I just don't see there's enough evidence that there is on this one. But you can't deny that Ashton seems to have done a hell of a lot of work, and, you know, seems pretty proud of the work he's done as well and put a lot of hours into it. So all the best with that, to be honest. Dan, I know we've touched on this, but anything?
A little bit. I'll be a little more damning just to kind of give a bit of juxtaposition. I followed this thing along since the start. You know, some things I don't talk about on here, but I will always keep an open mind and look at the evidence that people bring forward. MH370 is a sensitive one. You know, that's a personal kind of interest for me. I watch pretty much any video that I can find on it. And it's one of those God in the gap things, you know, when people hold on to theories and ideas too much, it can kind of hide the truth of it, you know? So far, I've pretty much seen, you know, Ashton challenge people to recreate the video in less than a whole bunch of time. I've seen people recreate it in 30 minutes with the exact same cloud assets that appear in the video, with the exact same flash that appears in the video. So for me, it is well and truly debunked, and I don't see a reason to kind of carry on looking at it. I'm sure Ashton will carry on looking at it, and that a few people will carry on looking at it. So I'm completely aware that we might see something pop up in like 2 months that proves that it's real or something like that. But for now, I'm squarely in the that's nonsense camp. You know, for a cloud, think of how many shapes clouds take. For them to find the exact shape, the exact same opacity, the exact everything as the clouds that were appearing in the video as just digital assets you can drag into an editing program and make a video with. For me, that was the line where I was like, yep, sure. Okay. I kind of have an idea of where this is going now.
Cool. Sean, thanks for your YouTube comment. We've answered that one with the David Grush op-ed stuff. Nemsiri asks, please ask a prominent guest, Dan, you're now said prominent guest. Why has Bob Lazar not done anything with his supposed piece of Element 115, considering he pushed for the UFO topic to be transparent with the public, and also because the UFO topic is in a state of hyper-momentum being the perfect time to do so? Why do you
that,
think?
I mean, because he doesn't have it. This is what I think. I could be wrong, but Jacques Vallée said that he saw it and it was aerogel, which is a something that you can just go get. Lazar said, oh no, it was contained within the aerogel. If he had 115, it would blow the lid off this whole thing. However, when Lazar started talking about 115, it had already been theorized. And as well, we just number things in the periodic table and we keep finding things beyond the elements that we know. So if you can count up, you can guess there's going to be an element 210 at some point and just, you know, pluck it out of the air. So for me, unfortunately, I've come to the conclusion that Bob just doesn't have it. I would love to see him walk into a public hearing and just plonk it on the table and just be like, have this and see it float or whatever. I don't think that's going to happen. Bob keeps saying, I don't owe the UFO community anything, and yet he's more than happy to keep taking people's money. So I don't really get what's going on with him, if I'm honest. And that'll sound harsh, but you know, this is a guy that supposedly has the secrets to the universe in his back pocket or buried somewhere in the yard. Do something. I'm fed up of poking him with a stick and asking for, you know, some truth. He's told his story. Yes, the story has changed a lot over the years, but ultimately it's still around. There seems to
people
be
people disputed that when
it.
You said that last time.
They do. And they did. But you know, 115 would kind of decisively prove me wrong here, right? And I'm not saying to Bob, like, prove me wrong. Like, he doesn't know who I am. He doesn't care what I think. But it revealing it would pretty much end this debate entirely, completely end the debate. So I don't see any good reason for him to not just come out with it, for not just go to someone like Gary Nolan and say, let's work on this. Let's show a bunch of tests. So like Jesse Michaels from American Alchemy, you know, he recently put a video up about anti-gravity and said, if there's any experiments that people want to do, let me know to prove or disprove them. I'll give you 50 grand. Do that. Let's see it. You know, we've moved past stories now, I think. And we're into the part of the conversation where we're saying, okay, well, if this proof exists, you know, time to pour up or shut up. The opportunity exists for Bob to come to a hearing. He doesn't want to do it. That's fine. But then he also needs to realize that a lot of people are going to call BS on that.
And you have to be fair, though, Dan, if you're going to take that stance, then the same could be said for when Lou Elizondo's book comes out, that they're just stories and he needs to come forward to hearings. That David Grush, they're just stories. He has to come forward with hearings. I know they're slightly different stories, but you can still see why there are people on different sides supporting and hating on all these folks as well. So I can appreciate why some folks are in different camps, and there's still an element. And I think it's fair to say, Dan, you've got folks that you like and will support more than others, but everyone does that. I don't know anyone that literally is totally non-biased, because I've said before, like, Stephen Greer, I'm pretty biased against him, but not to say that he's not done some good stuff. So that's, I think you've got 100%. To say that for the sake of parity.
Yeah, and a bias is something, you know, I'm aware of my bias against Bob after reading all of this information, but I'm not
showing your DNA
conversation. Yeah, that's what it is. I want him to be a part of this conversation. So, you know, I'm aware of my bias, and that's the part of me that's kind of keeping an open mind of being totally wrong. You know, let's see him at a hearing. I'd love nothing more.
It would be interesting, David, that much.
It would.
Last couple of ones are, Peter asked, do you know or can you find out what happened to Timothy Good? He got me into the subject with Above Top Secret. Peter, I read Above Top Secret back in the day when I was in secondary school or high school. Really enjoyed it. It kind of had me going through my early teens, really involved in the UFO topic, and a lot of good stuff in there. I'd love to have time to go back and read it again. I think I'm right in saying Timothy Good has just had some health issues over the last few years. He's advancing in years as well, and that's why he doesn't do interviews and whatnot. I don't believe he's deceased. I hope to God I've not seen that, and he is. But I'm sure quite a few folks who are British researchers have told me, yeah, he just stays out the limelight now because he's just not in the place to be doing it. So, you know, all the best to him. But yeah, he got a lot of folks into the subject with Above Top Secret. And a separate Peter just asked to wish well Chris Leto. Chris Leto obviously done some videos recently, got a little bit of attention online, some good, some less good. Chris has taken a break from the subject, but, you know, very much is going to still be involved. So yeah, just all the best to Chris, because he's done a lot of really good work, especially with his unique perspective being a former pilot. And he's got a lot of skills as well from a video analysis perspective, and I really like watching his content. So love to see Chris back sooner than later. Dan, same from you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my heart goes out to Chris, and I hope he's having an amazing time just relaxing with his family in the sunshine in Portugal. Project Hestdalen, the place in Norway that kind of studied anomalous lights, and they call them anomalous lights, but the scientists have since come out. Masamoto Teirani has since come out saying that, yes, they had to call them that because the scientific community wouldn't fund a UFO study. However, they were studying UFOs. That project has now taken over Chris's channel, so they're putting up videos about what's going on there and how they're trying to study this stuff. So I'd recommend go have a look. It's really interesting still. You know, Chris is taking a break, but they're just as compelling.
Dan, final comment from you. What's something you hope to or would like to see happen this March in terms of UFO news?
I think given my rant that's just passed, I would have to say that Bob Lazar proves me wrong. That's what I hope happens this month.
That would be fun. I think for me, I would like to see... this keeps coming back to me. I'd like to see Three Body on Netflix be a massive hit and really get people thinking about the UFO topic in a different way. 21st of March. Do you know what? They should just sponsor the podcast. 21st of March on Netflix, Three Body. Looks interesting. And I'm still working my way through the Chinese version, episode 9 upcoming. I'm going to go watch
it. It's going to be really interesting. Like, I'm really enjoying the conversations that you and I have about that, kind of, you know, outside of recording.
Have I missed something because I don't understand what I'm watching? And you say, no, you've not missed anything. You're exactly right. And I'm going, okay, that's fine. Just checking.
I mean, yeah, but also, you know, some of the concepts we've spoken about and things like that. I'm not going to say it because I don't want to spoil it for anyone.
No.
But suffice to say, we'll be talking about it on here in the future once we've both watched it. So I'm, you know, and if people want, like, in fact, let Andy know, having read the books, do people want me to compare them to the books, or would they rather I keep it spoiler free or just stick to the first book or what? You know, that, let us know.
Can maybe do a little section at the end of those and be like, you know, spoiler for those who haven't read the books, but here's what's coming up.
Yeah.
I can deal with that. I don't mind stuff being spoiled. I read the script for Kill Bill 2 when it leaked online long before I saw the movie.
Also one of the only scripts I've read.
Yeah. Always remember going to that last scene. But anyway, folks, here we go. Dan, thank you for joining me. Thank you very much for your time. Enjoy your evening. And folks, thank you very much for listening. We'll be back very, very soon. That is all for this episode. Thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. Apple and Spotify do make a huge difference to the algorithm. If you're checking the show on YouTube, please don't forget to like and leave a comment on here as well. Any sharing you do is very much appreciated on any social media platform. And finally, you can listen to shows ad-free and sponsor-free in their glorious full versions by subscribing for less than the price of a coffee on Apple, Spotify. Just search That UFO Podcast Premium. YouTube, you can sign up and be a member, or you can do that through patreon.com. Thank you very much for listening, folks.
It wasn't a tic-tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer.